Good afternoon. So last week we talked a bit about shells. We mentioned what shells were, which is kind of important since this is our current assignment. We talked about how files work in the POSIX API. We have this unified interface of a file, which we in fact in POSIX use not just for what we typically think of as files, as things stored on permanent storage with a name that you like open up in your word processor or other applications, but as just a general abstraction we use to represent all kinds of devices as well as data storage. And we have this commonality that we need to do some sort of open before we use a file. Now, that's not always the open function we saw with pipes. The open operation is the pipe call, but we have to do some preparation to make the file available to use. And once it's available, we can read and write in terms of bytes, even if the underlying device or whatever we're talking to doesn't really actually understand things in terms of bytes. And we have an explicit close operation when we want to get, stop using the file, assuming our process stays around. We don't want to reserve those resources. If we don't close, it's going to stay around. And in POSIX, we have to keep track of these open files, and the mechanism chosen is that we have a table of all the open files for every process, and the process uses indexes into that table, known as file descriptors, to actually figure out, to actually tell the operating system, that is, what file it should use for each read and write and other operation. And on fork, we just copy that table. And we copy that table at sort of a pointer level. So it's like a table of pointers to information about the file. Fork just copies all those pointers. So we have two processes after the fork, which both have pointers to the same open files. And we can also manipulate that table in other ways. And one big way we talked about for doing that is dupe2. So dupe2 says we'll take one of the pointers in a table entry and assign it to a different table entry. And this allows us to do something like, I have a file open in index 3, and I really want it to be index 1 because that's where I'm going to go for printf. So I want printf to go there. I can just reassign that pointer by calling dupe2 and asking the OS to do that for me. We also can think of close then. It's just deallocating a table entry by basically setting it to null and then making sure we don't leak memory. That was sort of our basic file mechanics, and we talked about a special type of file called a pipe. And a pipe is, you call this special system call to get a pair of file descriptors, and you write to one, and you're able to read from the other. We talked how that was implemented, typically, is that the operating system in the kernel is going to have some buffer where it puts the data that's written until it's read. And one use of that is when we talked about shells, we want to have this feature that exists in Unix-like shells where we can one command and have its output go to another command. And pipes are a way of making that happen without, say, reading the command's output and writing it to a temporary file ourselves and then inputting that temporary file manually. We can just connect them directly by changing what their input and output are using the dupe2 call to adjust those table entries. So any questions about these things we talked about last time before I move on? Yes?
For piping, can you go more in detail like how you connect two file descriptors into read and write? Is there a convention where zero is like read and one goes?
So the question is, so one question you have, we'll try to get to all your questions, but one question you have, so the convention where zero is always read and one is always write, that is what the pipe POSIX call does, and they made just an arbitrary choice. I don't expect you to memorize that choice. I asked it on the quiz because you can look things up on the quiz. And if, like, on an exam where you don't have access to those resources, we tell you. Or you could write it down in an assumption, and if you got it wrong, we still mark you correct. But that's just an arbitrary choice. And this is a system call, so what it's really doing typically is it's going to allocate a buffer, and it's going to set those two table entries to basically point to that buffer and say whether this is the read or write for the buffer. And then on the read system call, it's going to look at that table entry and say, oh, this is a pipe. Here's the buffer. This is, I'm going to adjust that buffer. And that's how it will be implemented. That answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I alluded to the shell assignment. So I made two corrections to the shell assignment, which are hopefully very minor. First, I wrote make submit in the assignment, which if you downloaded the supplied make file, it doesn't work because I meant to write make archive or change the make file, probably change the make file, but it's too late for that. So it should be make archive. Also, I adjusted the phrasing in the section on outputting exit statuses. The previous version implied that you had to wait PID in order. I don't care what order you call wait PID in. I just care that you output the exit statuses of all your programs in the order they appeared in a pipeline. So if you have a pipeline with like multiple commands, I want you to output how they exit in the order they appear in that line. I don't care how you get that information. So questions on these or the assignment in general? Yeah.
Just about pipes, can you talk about redirects like within a pipeline? Can you only have it on the very first?
So the question is, what happens with redirects within a pipeline? So you're thinking of like, so there's some easy cases. So like this command should run foo with its input being the text file input.txt and send its output to bar. That's a redirect in a pipeline. That should just work if you implement both of those. And that makes sense. The tricky case is what you do for something like this where you seem to have a contradiction. We don't plan on testing commands like this, which don't really make sense. But according to our specification, what it says is first you set up the pipelines, and then you do the redirection within each command in the pipeline. And what that means is first you'll make foo's output go to bar, and then you're going to overwrite that by making foo's output go to this text file, which I've now misnamed. And so the last thing you do will be what table entry survives. So when foo runs, its output will go to the text file rather than going to bar. And when bar tries to read from its input, there's not going to be anything there. But as I said, I don't plan on testing this because it's not a command anyone cares about. Other questions? Yeah. So you're saying if I do this, yeah, it's the same scenario. Bar should get its input from the file, but it's not a sensible command. We're not going to test it. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So let's start with a little refresher exercise. So take a look at this and tell me what are possible outputs of this code. And I may not have listed all the possible outputs, I just want to know what of the ones I've listed are possible. You can check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what's supposed to happen here. And you can see the intention of this code is we write 0, then 1, then 2, and so on to the pipe from the child, which exits after doing that. And in the parent, we read 10 bytes from the pipe. Who needs more time? Once more time? Okay, a couple. POSIX defines what the read and write into the pipe is, and even if you were confused about that, we guarantee tell you it doesn't fail.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Okay, so... So who thinks the answer is A? Okay, some hands. B, couple people. C, D, A and B. Okay, some people. E, A and C. And F, all of them. Okay, so we're very split. Very split. And so it turns out that multiple of the listed answers are possible. And let me talk about, like, one reason that can happen. So in our child process, so we have our parent, it splits off into parent and child. In our child process, we do a write, and then we want to do another write. And the question is, in our parent, when do we do the read? So if we do the read right here, then we're going to get the first write only. And read is going to return something because it's available, so it's not going to wait for the rest of it. Just like if I type something on the keyboard, read's going to give me what I type, give you what I type, not like just say, you didn't type 64 characters, too bad. So if we read there, we get one answer. If we say read further down here, after the child has done all its writes, we will get the A answer. So that means that both, so our 0 are possible and our 0 through 9 are possible. And I didn't show them, but also if we like have times in the middle here, we could get less than something in between. So that's one possibility. And then you might say, well, nothing is also possible. It seems like nothing should be possible because what if my, you know, I read right here, right up here. But the behavior of read by default is that if there's not data yet, it's going to wait for something to be there. So nothing isn't actually possible. We have to do something special to say, no, if nothing's there, I want you to tell me right away. Yeah. The question is, what's the significance of closing the file descriptors? So I'm doing it mainly to avoid leaking memory, basically. How does it impact the result? I don't believe it does in this case. In general, the rule is that a read is not going to return end of file. And remember, end of file is represented by returning 0 if there's anything that could write to it. So closing the write end, which I do right here in the parent, is needed if you want to eventually call read and get 0. Rather than, but otherwise, that doesn't happen in this case, right? We don't expect 0 from that. If we called read over and over again, we'd eventually get it. And that would be the only effect. But mostly I did it just to not leak memory. Yeah. So the question is, I have to have the file open to do the read or write, and like, why does it work with the close? So note that we have two file descriptors, which refer to two different open file descriptions. And all that matters is the one I'm using is open. Like, so the pipe creates, like, it's conceptually one file, but it creates two open file descriptions. We can use either one independently. They just point to the same thing underneath. Yeah?
So last one, we talked about having that write and then read, and it got blocked.
Yeah.
Is the only reason the write doesn't get like blocked there is because the pipe has like some kind of buffer or something where it returns?
So the question is, the only reason the write doesn't get blocked here because the pipe has some kind of buffer? Yeah, so the pipe has some amount of buffer space, and it's probably enough to store 10 bytes. In fact, I think it's actually guaranteed to be enough to store 10 bytes.
So if it was more than that, then...
So the question is, if we had a lot more, would we get some different effects? Yeah, so if I was doing not 10 characters, but like 100,000, yeah, we wouldn't expect the same kind of behavior. Necessarily. Yeah. B0. So the idea is the child calls write once, and then the parent calls read. Remember, the parent and child, they're just both runnable, and the OS decides when to run them. It could choose to run the child first, the parent first, and you just run the child for 1 millisecond, for 100 milliseconds. So if we just get the lucky timing where the child calls write, and then the OS decides, oh, time to switch to the parent. We'll get that. Yeah. So read can return after it gets any data. It's allowed to wait longer, but you know, it doesn't, you wouldn't be very happy if you had to like read byte by byte to not like show immediately what you just got. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So you need to call read multiple times in the case where the read happened farther.
Yeah, so in this case, the fix is, you know, the fix for what is probably a problem here is that if I want to make sure I get 10 bytes, I need to keep calling read. And this is even more important if we consider, like, one of the things I neglected here, that if they don't fail, you know, because another thing which could have happened is, like, something crashed or something in the middle.
So if you're looking for 10 bytes and you call read again, is it looking for a new 10 bytes?
So yeah. So if a question is like, if I get 5 bytes, let's say, and I call read again, what's it going to get me? It's going to get you the next bytes after those 5 bytes you already read. Yeah. Question is, can I solve this problem by saying wait PID? So I absolutely could, right here, call wait PID, or write before I read, in which case I would expect to read the whole 10 bytes. Now, there's two issues with that. So one is it's not, POSIX doesn't actually guarantee it, though I can't imagine an implementation not doing that, but POSIX doesn't require them to make that work right. An implementation's allowed to like say, oh, I'm gonna just randomly decide I don't have enough memory right now and not copy everything or something like that. But it's I can't imagine that happen. Now, the in a typical case, I can imagine some ways you could construct to make it happen. The bigger issue is that if I'm writing more than 10 bytes, I'm going to run out of space in the buffer, and the child's never going to finish one of its write calls. So in this case, it would work because we definitely have 10 bytes that we can store in the pipes buffer. But if it was much more data, we ran out of space, the child would call write, that write would wait for more space in the buffer, and there would never be any there. Yeah?
This is a syntax question. Why is it 0 plus I?
So the question is, what is the 0 plus I? This 0 is the constant for the ASCII character for the number 0. And I'm just adding I to that to get 0 through 9, because I know they happen to have consecutive ASCII codes. Yeah?
So I remember like in previous examples that we did of similar exercises to this, where we trace through like a fork, we have the child, right, I guess, I'm not sure if that's the right word, be in one if statement, and then there was an else statement that contained the parent.
Yeah.
Why aren't we doing that?
So the question is, this code doesn't follow the pattern I saw before, which is that I have an if-else statement with part for the child and part for the parent. I have an if statement where this is all for the child. And I just put my parent code afterwards. So it's the same because both the parent and child execute the if statement, and they both keep going afterwards unless something stops them. In this case, the child doesn't keep going because there's an exit call here, but the parent does, so it doesn't affect anything. Now, we typically have that pattern, you'll typically see that pattern partly because people like organizing the code they're doing to deal with the child there, and partly because you want a third case in your if-else statement to handle what if fork failed because like we're out of memory. Other questions? Okay. So that's about And that's everything I have basically on reads and writes. So this is an example of partial reads, basically. That read doesn't need to read everything. And this is particularly comes up with pipes because, you know, because when we're reading from another program, we probably want to get the data that's available sooner rather than like waiting for a long time. So this is generally, they'll give you with the data that's available, even if that's less than everything. So our next topic, we're going to talk about processes and scheduling processes. So you mentioned this possibility that there were lots of ways that the parent and child could be interleaved, and that was part of the reason we had these different possible outputs. And this has to do with what the scheduler does, what the part of the OS, which decides what do I run now on the CPU, is doing. We're going to talk about sort of mechanically how that works, looking at like what XV6 scheduler, where the code actually is, how does it get run, and then we're going to talk more generally about what are good ways of writing schedulers in operating systems. So one thing a scheduler needs is it needs to know what are the processes. And XV6 has chosen that there's just a fixed-sized array of all processes. It's of size nproc, where nproc is a constant that is not that big. Obviously, in a quote-unquote real OS, you probably make this like a dynamic array or a linked list, something a little more flexible, but XV6 is keeping things simple. We also have next to it a lock. We'll talk more about how locks work, but the purpose of this is to keep more than one thing from accessing this at once. So in particular, if we have two cores, we don't want something running on one core to be changing what programs can be run right now if another core is trying to read the list and determine what to run. And that lock is to prevent that from happening. And so our rule is whenever we manipulate this list of processes, like changing what can be run right now, we're going to, what's known as acquire the lock, to make sure no one else is manipulating it until we're done. So there's one operation related to processes that we like alluded to with the fork system call, but we didn't exactly talk about how all the details of it were done in XV6. So like I showed you how the first thread was started, we talked about setting up the stack, but we need to do that with one of these processes. So one thing we need to do is when we're starting a new process, we need to allocate an entry in this array in XV6. So that's actually fairly simple. We just look for an array entry. We just look for an entry with a state value of unused, and we probably mark it as used somewhere where GoToFound is. Yeah. So PCB is the process control block. So that's struct proc, which we talked about before. We'll revisit that a little later. So to allocate one, we just iterate through the table, and we look for one entry which has a state of unused. This obviously is not the most efficient strategy, but it works, so that's what they're doing, just to keep things nice and simple. So they have this code in found, which deals with if we find it, now we use the entry, and if it's not found, we finish this loop, and we return an error from fork. So in XV6, this error would be for, oh, we're out of processes, we can't run anymore, because I ran out of table entries. That's allocating table entries. And we'll see this pattern a lot in XV6 of when we want to find a process that meets some criteria, we just iterate through all the processes, checking each one. So that's not the fastest solution, but it's a workable solution, and it's kind of a relatively simple idea to think that in a more performance-focused OS, we probably have some data structure that like tracked all the unused struct procs and everything else we might be iterating through all the processes to find. So this is what we do on fork. And we talked about forking for creating processes, but we kind of have a missing piece. And that question is like, how do we boot? When we boot, something has to be running, and we can't call fork, because what are we going to copy? What process control block are we going to copy? We can't do that. So we need to have a special case to start the first process. And in XV6, this code is in a function called userInit. So what userInit does is it allocates a process, the same way that would be done for fork, but it needs to fill it in manually. So one thing it does to fill it in is it has a hard-coded program. So rather than like loading it from an executable file, we just have a hard-coded program in the kernel that is the executable we want to run for the first program. And what this program does is it calls basically execv/init. So we're going to use the normal run a different program, but this is just the little bit of code to make that system call to replace it with the actual first program we want to run. So our convention is going to be that we're going to run this program called init, and the system administrator is going to make sure that program does whatever they want to happen on boot. And in the case of XV6, the supplied init program runs a shell. But we could change that without changing the kernel. We wanted to like run some other service. And what we're doing here is we're just loading the code to start that program. So not even the contents of that program. We don't have that. We just have the minimal assembly code to like make the system call to start that program. And we just manually set the user's context, which is, remember, the registers saved as if we had a trap, an exception. And we manually set up the stack pointer to point somewhere that we have some stack space allocated, which is actually going to be after the code. And we manually set the program counter to be the beginning of where we load that code. And it turns out we loaded at address 0, just to keep things simple. The question is this having a hard-coded initial program, just an XV6 thing? This is probably just what XV6 chose to do to handle this, but it's a nice simple solution because all you need to implement is running new programs and for like the shell, and you're done. But the idea of starting a designated program called init is what typically POSIX systems do. So they typically, their first process is they just run this program called init. The system administrator decides what init does, and that's how they determine what happens on boot. Okay. Other questions? Okay. And not shown here is we do the same sort of setup otherwise that we do for returning from fork. It's just that we adjust where we return to make sure we start at the beginning of this hard-coded call init code. And we mark the process as runnable. And what that's going to do is when we talk about how the scheduler works, the scheduler is going to scan all the processes in the process list, that array, and look for runnable ones, and it's going to start them. So that's all we have to do to make sure it eventually gets run. So, as I said, we're going to talk about scheduling now that I've gone through this bookkeeping of how do we start a first program. And we're going to talk about actually thread scheduling. So I have to talk a little about threads versus processes for that to make sense. So a thread is the part of a process that runs on the CPU. So it's the saved registered values in the program counter. And there's also the rest of the process, which we won't call part of the thread. And the reason we won't do that is because we're going to talk about the possibility of having multiple threads for a process, which you can think of running your program on multiple CPUs, and maybe that means you really run on multiple cores. Maybe that means you run on one CPU, but you have different parts of your program that the OS switches between. But either way, we have the separate part of the program for things which aren't the part which runs on the CPU, like your open files. All the threads of a program are going to have the same open files. So if you change where standard out goes, all the threads that write to standard out are going to write to a new location. They're all going to have the same address space, that they're going to be able to access the same memory. So we'll talk about how that works with the stack in a couple weeks. But for like global variables, every thread that reads the same global variable is going to get the same value. They can change that value, and everyone will see that. Now, XV6, if we're talking about it, it has this process control block, which kind of confuses these two notions. Because part of this process control block is the information about each thread. We have where the kernel stack is. That's per CPU, because that determines what we do on an exception. And that's each CPU that we're running on could have a different exception at the same time. We have the state, like are we running or not? That's are we on a CPU or not? So that's a thread information. The saved registers from the user, that's part of the thread. And the saved registers from the kernel and what we're waiting for. So this is all information related to putting the program on the CPU. And this is the per thread information. So this is mixed in with all the per process information like the PID and the open files in XV6. But in other OSs, we're going to have multiple copies of this information. So we can have multiple threads per program. So the program can do multiple things at once. So you can run on two CPUs at the same time by having two versions of this data for the program. So conceptually, what we'll get is XV6 has this notion. We have our process data, files, PID, our memory, and the information for the thread of the stack, its registers, and so on. We're just going to have multiple copies of that in a multi-threaded process. And when we're talking about scheduling, we're talking about scheduling these individual threads. So in XV6, it's the same as scheduling processes, but in general, it's not going to be the same. So questions about this idea of multi-threaded processes? Yeah. So the question is, what counts as a process and what counts as threads? So that's an operating system decision, not a core number of cores decision. So we can have multiple threads with one core. And so if you think of, if I'm running two processes with one thread each, I have two threads. If I'm running one process with two threads each, I have two threads. And we can use the same scheduling decisions in both cases. We have two threads. We need to decide when do we run them. So it doesn't actually matter what process they're a part of for deciding what to schedule. All we need to know is we have this list of threads, choose which ones to run. Now, which process they're a part of is going to affect how like we switch to them and so on, but it's not going to affect whether or not we can run them in some order. Your question? So the question is, what's the difference between the multi-threaded process and having multiple processes? So if we had multiple processes, we'd have multiple copies of this data. So we'd have another box with different files, a different PID, different code, and different data. Now, the code and data might be the same information, the same bits, but we'd have different memory allocated, at least conceptually. But with a multi-threaded process, that's shared. So there's like literally one thing in memory, which is the data loaded for the program, no matter how many threads it has in this multi-threaded process. Other questions? Yes. So the question is, for the single-threaded process, when we switch, we replace. I don't understand your question. Sorry.
Oh, is a single-threaded process just like one thread that doesn't do anything else?
Question is a single threaded process like one thread and doesn't do anything else. So it can only there's only one thing we can put on the CPU in the single threaded process, if that's what you mean. So the program is only doing one thing at a time, if that's what you're trying to get at. Yeah. The question is, does the process decide which thread to run in the multi-threaded process case? So this is something which varies. We're going to talk about the most common implementation, where the answer is basically no. The operating system is just going to have all the threads, and it makes whatever decision it wants, and it doesn't even need to care what processes those threads are a part of. But there are other designs where the process would be involved in that decision. Other questions? So we have these threads, either one per process or many per process, and they have different states that we need to track of, and I'd like to go over because so we can get an idea of like what's going to happen that the operating system is going to need to manage. And I have the names of the states that, you know, some more human readable names and the constants that exist in XV6. So our programs start in this new state, and XV6 has an embryo state. And this represents, this is a process which is used. It's not something you can allocate anymore, because it's already in use, but it's not actually set up completely. So this is the state a process is going to have, for example, while fork is running, before we're ready to actually, before we set up everything so fork can finish. So then we have this ready state, which XV6 calls runnable. And these are processes which are not currently running on any core, but could. The operating system is able to switch to these safely if it wants to. And so we're going to talk about scheduling. And the scheduling decision that we're most concerned with is there's a bunch of these processes which are runnable. Which one do we switch to right now, if any? There's also this running state, and this is for processes which we are actually switched to, which are on a CPU right now. And notably, this means if you want to figure out like what's the current program counter in that process, well, it's not in the process control block, you have to ask the CPU. Because that's where that information currently is, until it's done running on the CPU. And we mentioned one way it could be done running is like we have a timer interrupt, and the OS stops it from running. We also have this waiting state, which XV6 calls sleeping. And this is waiting for some sort of external event to happen. So these things you can't switch to right now because they need something to happen, like they're waiting for a key press to happen, or they're waiting for a certain amount of time to pass. But we need to keep track of them, and we're going to need to transition them to being ready when that event happens. We also have this finish state, which XV6 calls zombie, and this is done in except for being waited for. So we mentioned that if you call wait PID, it needs to give you the exit status. So if a process exits, XV6 is chosen, it's going to keep the process around until you actually retrieve that exit status, and then it's going to get rid of it. It needs to keep something about it around because you want to know that if you waited for, you know, PID 100, that it's the program that you just ran and not some other program with PID 100. So we need to at least reserve the PID until it's waited for, and this is just the zombie state is just tracking that we need to keep it around so we can return that exit status. But otherwise, it's almost cleaned up. Okay. So this is what a process does from start to finish, in at least in XV6. And there's another way of viewing this, which is in terms of queues. So one thing we we could say there is that rather than saying a process becomes runnable, we add it to what we call the ready queue. So this is a list of runnable processes. And the operating system, whenever it decides to run something else, is going to look at this list, choose something from it, and make it go on the CPU and get to use CPU cycles. So a timer interrupt or something like that might trigger that decision. And when a process is done being on the CPU, well, if it ran out of time, we're going to put it on this ready queue. If it, say, asks to read or write, we're going to put it on a different queue. We're going to have a queue for things which are waiting for some I/O operation. And here I have just one, but we probably have like one for the keyboard, one for the network, and so on. We have a whole bunch of these for every possible type of I/O, and like when we had a key press, we'd look at the keyboard's I/O queue and take something off it and deal with it. And we also might have other queues, like for processes which are waiting for wait PID, or for processes which called sleep for 10 seconds. And we take them off when the appropriate event happens, a program finishes or an amount of time passes. So you can think of here what the OS is doing. It's rather than changing states, it's just moving processes around between these queues. And we have our big scheduling decision. So XV6 doesn't use this approach, but it's a good conceptual idea to think about it this way. XV6 just changes the state, and when it wants to figure out what are all the ready processes, it doesn't have a queue of them. It just scans the entire list of all processes, figures out, is this ready, is this ready, is this ready? Obviously, it probably would be more efficient if we just had a list of only the ready processes rather than scanning everything. And this is, in fact, what most sort of commercial OSs do. They'll have separate lists for each thing, so when you're trying to schedule a process, you don't scan all the processes, you just look at only the ones you might want to schedule. And if you're smart, you'll keep those in the order where you want to use them, so you don't even need to look at that whole list. You just take, you know, the first thing off it, and you're done. And maybe you'll be able to do that. So questions about, yeah? So scheduling, this is our next big topic, is just the decision. We have this queue. We have this list of processes. How is the queue sorted? Or how do we take something off that queue? And we're going to talk about it mostly for the ready queue, but we have all these other queues, and some of them have scheduling decisions. For example, this I/O queue here, maybe we have a hard drive, and there are multiple things we want to do with the hard drive, and we need to decide what order do we do them then. That's another scheduling decision. And some of these policies that we'll talk about for dealing with the CPU will apply to that, some of them won't. We're going to just focus on, you know, what we do for the CPU, but there's a lot of ideas we'll talk about which apply in those other contexts. Yes?
Why are we talking about removing processes and threads from the queue if XV6 doesn't use a queue?
So the question is, why are we doing that if XV6 doesn't use a queue? So XV6 doesn't like use a queue as the data structure, but we can view what it's doing as if there was a queue. So the contents of the queue are just all the processes labeled as ready. Removing one from the queue is just making it go from ready to running. Like, there's not explicit, like, actual queue remove, queue add, but the effect is the same. Other questions? Is it good? So we're mostly going to be talking about this CPU scheduling problem. And in fact, CPU scheduling, where we have like a whole bunch of processes and we want, like we're typing things and so on, there are some other scheduling problems which are, you know, some of the same things we're going to apply for, which are very different. So I mentioned I/O scheduling, like if we have a hard drive, what order do we read things in from the hard drive? If I have a network, what order do I write things out to the network? We can also think of like batch job scheduling. If I have a supercomputer and lots of people who want to use it, what order do I run those people's jobs in that are going to take days? Do I run the 1 day one first or the 7 day one first? So these are all going to have different trade-offs and different choices, but we're mostly going to focus on CPU scheduling, and not just CPU scheduling, but CPU scheduling with a few extra things going on. So one thing is we're going to assume programs do a lot of I/O. So our idea of how programs are going to work are that they're going to do some computation, then they're going to do some I/O. Like they're going to do some computation, then read from the keyboard, or do some computation, and send something to the network and wait for a response. That's going to be what our notion of a typical program is. And we're going to talk about scheduling methods which work well in those contexts, which may not be the ones which work well in those other things, like those supercomputer jobs or for using a hard drive. We're also going to have the simplifying assumption of only a single CPU. And obviously, that's a very poor assumption, but that's going to keep the problem simpler because I'm already booking a lot of time for scheduling, and we need to book even more time to constructively talk about things which are different when we have multiple cores. The basics are going to be the same, but there's extra things you'd want to do to really be intelligent about using multiple cores that we're just going to ignore. And we're going to talk about these basic ideas. Many of our very basic things we're going to do are going to work well for other scheduling problems. We're going to have some more complicated things we'll talk about which won't, where we'll really take advantage of that we're doing I/O and so on. So we're going to want to talk about scheduling policies. So one thing we want to know is what is XP6's scheduling policy? So we're going to have to figure that out. So let's look at the XP6 scheduler itself. So XP6 has this unusual architecture that the scheduler actually runs as a separate thread. So there's a thread, which is the scheduler. And the way you switch to another program is you first switch to the scheduler, and then the scheduler switches to that other program. So here's the code which runs as that scheduler thread. It has an infinite loop. And every iteration of this loop, it's going to switch to a thread and then switch back, at least once. The first thing it does in that loop is it enables interrupts. So this is to make sure that we have a chance, if there's a key press happened, that we have a chance to make sure the processes are updated and we know you should run this thing that a key press just happened for. If we don't do that, we might get into a case where we don't explicitly handle that. Then we have this bunch of code which runs where we're the only ones manipulating a list of processes. And we want to do this because let's say we have two cores. Each core is going to have its own scheduler running. And we don't want both of them to decide at the same time, I'm going to run this program and have two copies of the program running all of a sudden, two copies of the thread. So to avoid that, we use this lock. We'll talk about how the lock works in several weeks. The important thing is it makes sure no one else runs at the same time. And it also disables interrupts, it turns out. So it's going to prevent us from deciding to, a timer interrupt happens to switch to the scheduler again. That would be very confusing. We run the scheduler, and then in the scheduler, we decide to run the scheduler again. So this prevents that from happening. So we also... Then what it does is it iterates through all the processes in the order they appear on the table, and it skips over all the ones which aren't runnable. Runnable, remember, means we can put it on the CPU right now. And when it finds one that's runnable, it just takes that and runs it. It switches to it, runs it for a bit, and then it's going to switch back to this loop. So in this loop, we'll run a little bit of the program. The program's going to finish. We'll have a timer interrupt or a read system call, and it's going to switch back to the scheduler, and it's going to do the next iteration of the loop and try to find another program to run. Yes?
Just to make sure, it basically just finds the first one.
question is that it just finds the first one and then runs it. So that's the first program which runs in this loop. After that, we're going to find the one after it in the table. Yes? Question, and when I talked about XP6, am I using the words thread, program, and process interchangeably? Yes. I should try to just use thread or process. Sorry. Yeah.
So while it's running a process, I see up there where it says when it's done, example, timer interrupt. Is it more likely to just run it until the process finishes on its own or to stop?
The question is, like, when is it likely that the process likely to switch back? So it depends how long it wants to run for. So, like, if the process is just, like, if most of what it's doing is, like, reading another key from the keyboard, it's probably not going to run for very long and we'll switch back voluntarily, right, from a read system call. But if a timer interrupt happens, XP6's policy is we always switch to the scheduler. So if it runs long enough for a timer interrupt, we're done. Yeah.
Once you find a process and you switch, is that lock released, or do you come back to that?
So the question is, what happens to this lock? And we'll talk about that later. It is released, and we'll show how. So here's, first of all, the code for switching to a process. And this doesn't have our lock release. We'll get to it later. But we've chosen our process P. So what we do is we store that process P as the current process. That's what the cproc is. We use switch UVM says change to its address space, so we make sure that we've loaded the process in memory. We'll talk about how that works when we talk about virtual memory way late in the semester. It just says load the process in memory now. It's the current thing in memory. And then it marks it as running and switches to it. And it switches to its kernel thread. Remember, it switches kernel to kernel switch. Presumably, that kernel thread is then going to like return from a system call or return from an exception to start running the user code. Okay. So that's that. And that's going to run for a while. And after that thread runs for a while, it's going to switch back. Either a timer interrupt will happen, or it will just like make a system call that switches back. And that's, remember, when we call switch, it returns from another call to switch. So the other program's going to call switch, and it's going to return right after here, right to here. So after it's done, the first thing we do is we unload it from memory. That's what switch KVM does. And we mark it as not running. So if you look up the current process, you'll find out nothing's running right now. So questions about this? Yeah.
So if the scheduler has a lock on the P table, then for like this entire process, then when and why would somebody else access the process table?
Question, why would someone else access the process table? So one thing which is going to happen is when we switch to that other process, it's going to release that lock. So another thing which would happen is XP6 supports multiple cores. So something on another core could want to use it, even though we aren't invoking that code. Okay, so let's talk about examples of how do we switch to this. So first of all, let's talk about starting a process. I mentioned, you may vaguely recall, that when fork is called, we create a new thread, and that new thread starts executing right here. So this is where the scheduler switches, right here. And what happens is there's a little bit of code, and then we release that process table lock. So after we're done with the switch, we finish the switch here. And once we're done finishing the switch, we release the process table lock because it's OK for other people to figure out, is this program running or not, because now that information's up to date. We can't do it before we switch because we have this problem that if we switch like right here, if we release the lock right here, then someone looks at the processes that are running and they'll say, this is running, but we haven't switched to it yet. So this ensures that no one checks what's running and finds something which hasn't been switched to yet. Because they're going to wait until we're done switching to that program. Yeah?
So that switch goes to that fork thread.
So this is one of the places it can go. This is where it goes when a process starts. I'll show you some other examples of where it can go, but they all have similar code. So here, you know, we switch, it goes to here, and we eventually release the lock. And then return to start running the program. In this case, returning from a fork system call. And the idea of holding a lock is that nothing is going to interfere with what process is marked as runnable while we're changing that from running to runnable to running. And nothing else is going to see what's going on until we're done. And notably, this means other cores, and it also means if, like, we have a timer interrupt, the lock is going to prevent that from happening until we're done. Because it would be really confusing if we tried to switch while we're switching from a timer interrupt, for example. Okay. So I mentioned timer interrupts. So this function is called by the timer interrupt. It's called yield. So it acquires the process table lock. And it wants to switch to the scheduler. So in preparation for doing that, it marks the current thread as not running anymore, but runnable. So we're not waiting for anything. We just want to let something else run. Like a timer interrupt happens, if there's something else to run, we want to run it. So we mark us as runnable rather than running, and then switch to the thread. And note that we have this period of time here where if you scan the process list, you wouldn't find anything running with one if there was one core, but something was, which is why we have it locked, so nothing does that. We just stop that from happening until we go to the scheduler and the scheduler starts running something again. So when we call this sketch function, it's going to return from that call to switch in the loop. It's going to go to the next iteration of that loop over all the programs, find the next program that's runnable, and switch to it. If there's only one runnable program, we're going to go through the whole loop and the outer loop and go all the way around. So we saw this loop here. If only one program is runnable, it returns here. We're going to release the lock, go to the top of this loop, acquire the lock again, and find that one program that was runnable. Okay. If not, we're going to go back to the loop and we're going to find the next runnable program, which might be a different one. Yeah. Question is, how does the scheduler access the ptable if the lock hasn't been released? So the way the locks work is they don't stop you from accessing ptable. What they do is they make acquire not work. Acquire stop you. So the reason that this prevents other people from accessing it is that everyone else is going to follow the rule of calling acquire before trying to use the ptable. And if they don't do that anywhere, we have a problem. But fortunately, all the XV6 code obeys that convention enough to make it work. Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah, I gave you the impression like it just stops it. It doesn't actually stop it. You have to always use acquire and release when you're accessing the states of the processes, or else you might see things that are changing from runnable to running at the wrong time. So there's that. And after we switch using this, later on, the scheduler is going to decide to run this program again, especially because it's marked as runnable. And it's going to switch back, and that means we're going to return from this switch call into the original program, which yielded the CPU briefly. So we had a timer interrupt. We go back to the scheduler for a while, and eventually the scheduler says, oh, you should still keep running. And it's going to switch back to us, and we're going to return from that timer interrupt operation. So questions on this? Yeah?
Why would you want to yield versus just trying to run as much of your thread?
So the question is, why would you want to yield instead of running as much? So this is a function in the kernel. So the kernel is deciding when an exception happens, it wants to yield the CPU on your behalf. So that's the most common case. So if a timer interrupt happens, this is the code the kernel runs. It's not running it because you decided I don't want, as the program writer, not to use the CPU. It's doing it involuntarily. Now, we also have, in our version of XV6, a system call which just calls this. And you might do that if you know that I don't have anything useful to do, but run something else, please. That's a way of doing that, giving a hint to the OS that, hey, something else should run that would be useful. Yeah?
So the only time you'll come back to that is once you've gone through that list.
The question is, the only time we return from the sched is after the schedule has gone through the list? Yes. Yeah. Yes?
So if sched works the same as switch, would you not be able to release the lock since you have to come back to it?
So the question is, why can I release the lock here? So what's going to happen underneath the... So why this works is that the scheduler is carefully written to make sure we've acquired the lock when we get here, so we should release it. And it makes sure that's always true. And I haven't showed you all the code to prove that, but I assert that that's always true. And that's why this is okay. Yeah. What's always true is that the lock has been last acquired and not released. So when we switch to the scheduler, we've done it after acquiring the lock. And when the scheduler switches to us, it's acquired the lock and not released it since. And this makes sure that we can manipulate the process states and be okay. Other questions? Okay, so another side of things, yeah, is we have a sleep call. So sleep, this function, you might be familiar with sleep as like wait a certain amount of time. This is the actually wait for any sort of IO function. And the way it works in XV6 is there's this void star, this pointer, that just points to the thing you're waiting for, and we look that up later. So if we went to wait, if we have a key press happen, have a pointer that represents the keyboard, we scan for that in all processes, and that's how we know which ones to make not be sleeping anymore. So the code here, it acquires the process table lock because we're changing the state to sleeping while it's still on the CPU, and we don't want anyone to see that until the scheduler fixes it. So then we change the state to sleeping and record why the process is sleeping. Why is it not runnable anymore? And then we switch to the scheduler, so something else gets run, and we're no longer running. And eventually, some code is going to run, like an interrupt handler, that's going to cause us not to be sleeping anymore. So something's going to edit our state back to runnable. And when that happens, the scheduler will find us, and we'll return from sched. So in the middle of this call to the scheduler, we run some other code, and eventually that other code causes us to not be sleeping anymore. And at that point, we can release the lock and return, and we're like ready to finish the read or whatever else triggered us to go to sleep, to wait for an event. Questions on that idea? Yeah. So the question is, when I switch away, I still have the lock? Yes. And the reason I have the lock is because the scheduler is going to needs to have that lock be held because it's going to be changing what's running right now. Now, the lock's going to get released when the scheduler goes to another iteration of this loop and changes another program to running. We switch to that program. It's going to release the lock. So when do we reacquire it? What do you mean? So, when the scheduler switches to us, it has the lock. That's a guarantee. And the reason it has the lock is the act of switching changes whether something is running or not. So we want to make sure we only do that with a lock so no one like tries to see what's running while that's changing. Okay. Other questions? So we see we have this marker called chan of what we're waiting for, and XV6 has this function to just scan all the programs to find one which is sleeping with a particular pointer and mark it as runnable. And this is how that our thing which was like waiting for a key press, this function gets called to mark it as runnable, and eventually the scheduler runs, not right away, but eventually. And the scheduler will figure out, oh, it's runnable, and run it to finish like reading from the keyboard. Okay, this makes sense. Okay, so I've went through the XV6 scheduler, partly because our assignment after shell is to modify the scheduler. So you need to use acquire and release correctly, but we don't care much about details other than that. You just need to not break the current code. We'll talk more about how that works later. And to go over these, like some design decisions XV6 makes. So XV6 has this separate scheduler thread. We switch to the scheduler is writing this loop, the scheduler switches to whatever you want. This is not the only design choice. So many other OSs, instead of switching to a separate scheduler thread, they just call a scheduler function, and that function switches directly. This does less switches, so it's faster. The disadvantage is now we need to track the state of the scheduler explicitly, where in XV6, we know what process we're on because of this P here, which is just a local variable. You know, so that we didn't have to actually write code to like save what's the next process to look at. Instead, we just use a local variable. And here. XV6 does the scanning of the process list to find, you know, sleeping, waiting threads, and so on. Otherwise, it's just maintain separate lists. So the pro is that those lists are faster. The con is that now making a program go to sleep is more complicated. You have to add it to the list, and you have to remove things from the list. So there's a little more bookkeeping, which is why XV6 doesn't do it. Okay, so we talked about how the scheduler works. So any questions on that before I move on to much higher level discussion, which will be remaining 3 minutes and to on Thursday. Okay. So XV6, we need to say what runnable program do we run? XV6 makes the decision, it's the next one in the list, or if you get to the end of the list, we go back to the beginning and find the first thing. That's their decision. So that's an answer XV6 has chosen because it's really easy to implement. What would be the best answer? What? How should I choose the program? And then give me some ideas. Like, what things should I take into account? Yeah?
If you're in a window and the user is within that window, then it should have a higher priority.
Yeah. Window used by the user. Okay. Any other ideas? Things that like should take into account? Yeah. Okay. So waiting the longest. Yeah. Okay. Finish quickly. Yeah.
Like hardware interrupts should have higher priority.
So. Okay, so, you know, does it involve hardware, access? Yeah. So user input, so which is the same as window used by user, well, same idea. Okay, yeah. So critical service. Sorry for bad writing. So we have a mix of things here, and one thing I'd like to separate for us to think about is that some of these ideas are policy ideas. They're ideas that things that the user is using are more important, and some of these ideas are more mechanism ideas, like take the thing which will finish first, finish most quickly. That's more of a, there's something you're trying to do by doing that, like, which, but the that's not the goal. The goal is to get things to finish, probably, lots of things finish, not to run the thing that finishes quickly first. So we're going to look at scheduling next time and talk about what policies make sense. And we're going to have to talk about how do we identify, is a schedule good or bad? And you have some things which come up from this, like how responsive it is. And we're going to try to quantify that in a particular old set of assumptions that people have studied with.